Hi, this is Katie Day, and welcome to Creating Ripples, the programme that showcases inspirational women across the globe. Sometimes it is the small acts and achievements that can create the biggest ripples. We're here to share some amazing stories. They will make you laugh. Sometimes they may make you cry. They will always inspire you. Today, it is my absolute pleasure to be interviewing Elaine Sullivan. Elaine firmly believes that we all have the ability to be great, to be leaders in our fields. She's been driven to not only deliver that for herself, but also to motivate others to find such inspiration. Elaine caught the technology bug at the age of 9 and went straight from school to work within the IT industry. And by the age of 24, she was the network manager for Compaq UK, now HP. And also headed up Compaq's European Network Managers Group. Over the years, her career has seen her work with companies such as IBM, Siemens, Fujitsu, Aviva, Vodafone and O2 in various capacities. Having seen at first hand the challenges of women in the workplace, particularly in the technology field, which is still a predominantly male environment, she started her own business, Skybrook Consultants. And today, her approach to speaking, training, and coaching uses her real life in the trenches experience to offer insights and guidance to women and men alike on leadership, collaboration, and inclusion. Her enthusiasm is infectious, she's engaging, she connects with her audiences, and she reaches out to enable and inspire others to be the best they can be. Thank you, Elaine, so much for being interviewed. And I love that last statement, inspire others to be the best they can be. How often do you come across people who don't do that?
It's a lot more often than perhaps I'd wish it to be. I think we all have this idea of who we are, but few of us get to the stage of thinking who we can be. And somebody actually said to me, it was a lovely statement, that you already are that you seek. So whatever you can dream and whatever you want to be, it's already there. You just need to give it a little bit of a push. And that people being the best that they can be takes them to have the right mindset and the people around them, the supporting cast to their own life, to be able to encourage them to just get out and do what they love and be who they really, really want to be.
It's an amazing thing, isn't it? And my experience of working for many decades with people and hopefully inspiring and empowering them on some level to do precisely that, be the best versions of themselves that they can be, whatever that looks like for them. What I've witnessed is fear, but fear on two levels. Fear that I'm a fraud and I'm going to get caught out, and people are going to point the finger and think, aha, got ya, knew you didn't really know what you're talking about. And also fear of how the people around them are going to react, and will they alienate people? Because a lot of the people we expect to be our biggest supporters can end up not being, because we suddenly become a threat. Is that your experience in working with people as well, of similar blocks that they may have to hold themselves back?
Yeah, and I think it's not necessarily somebody becoming a threat. They become somebody different. So, you know, as a wife or a mother or whatever, if we're focusing totally on those external to ourselves in those capacities, the moment that we start doing something different, so the moment we start becoming a greater version of ourselves, we're not the people that those closest to us know and obviously love, and they feel uncomfortable by that change and transition because we're all creatures of habit. Mm. You know, I want my mum to be the one that is always going to be there at 5:30 in the evening making my tea. And oh my goodness, she's suddenly gone out, got this course, she's got this wonderful job, and she's not there for me now. So it's not them being threatened by the individual, but their life is being changed as a result of the change that happens. And I think that is probably one of the more difficult things that we need to overcome. We know that we can have you know, we can go out, we can get the courses, we can go out and interact, we might be deciding to create our own business or moving from one role to another. But your show called Creating Ripples, you create your own ripples in the same way when you do that for yourself.
Yeah, it's interesting when you were saying about the change, and before we started the interview, we were just having a conversation about computers, that yep. you've got a new computer and you're saying, hang on a minute, that were I don't know where things are on the keyboard. And it's whenever we change something, like even as simple as that, our subconscious is so tuned in, isn't it, like radio waves, to yep. automatically going to a certain place on the keyboard or knowing where everything is, and suddenly you've got to reprogram it and you've got to build those neural pathways again. And that transition can be really challenging, and we go through the phase of actually, oh, for goodness sake, I want my old computer back, because I knew what to do then. So yeah, I absolutely get what you mean, that it's not necessarily a threat, but it's just going through that period of adjustment until the new you, or the new other person, if you're close to that person, becomes the familiar.
Yes. Yeah. And we are all creatures of habit. I mean, going back to your analogy in the computer and saying, I want my old one, that's actually what was going through my head. It would be quicker if I did so-and-so, so-and-so, so-and-so. It would be less aggravating if I didn't make this change and I went back to how I did. Mm. And I think whilst we're in a positive frame of mind, whilst we're upbeat about the changes that we're doing, then we can overcome that need to sort of have a little bit of comfort. But it's when we start getting into a stressful position that we immediately try and revert back to the type that has served us so well, but really might not necessarily be serving a purpose today.
Yeah.
And it's having that strength of character. And what you were saying about the people around you, if your strength of character is strong and you've got great supportive people that want you to be the best that you can be, then you can really go forward and go forward very, very quickly. But if your supporting cast, your mum, your dad, your children, your husband or whoever are feeling that uncomfortable, then it's going to be very, very difficult to break through that mould. And the same thing happens in the work environment as well. Young leaders that are moving up from a team role up to a more leadership role, they're going to have to interact differently with those people that are around them. And I think that can cause its own challenges too.
It can. I can remember doing some work with a police constabulary in the UK and talking to a young woman who was a constable and wanted to move up the career ladder, and the next stage it was sergeant. And I was working with her and saying, you know, just be aware your behaviour as a constable needs to reflect what you think your behaviour should be when you're the chief constable.
Yes.
Because if you behave one way as a constable and suddenly you become a sergeant and you are line managing the people that you went down the pub with on a Friday night and were a bit laddish with, how are you going to get their respect, and how are you then going to be their superior? So actually, right from the very beginning of your career, your behaviour needs to reflect where you're aiming, not where you are today. And she took that on board and said, yeah, actually, you're right. And she just made some adjustments so that she was preparing herself for her future. I wonder, in your experience, how many people do that? Or, you know, are they that proactive or are they more reactive?
I think the people that I've come across do fall into both camps. You have people that really understand what their direction is going to be, where they're going to get to. You know, they might be the, in your case, the constable, but they understand that their path is so much bigger than that, and therefore they will start planning, they will start thinking, they will start thinking about, well, my actions here. Young kids that have a LinkedIn profile that's really, really professional and a Facebook profile that, you know, shows them out on the town, you know, drinking up, falling over and that sort of thing. So having those two merge together, which is what's going to happen when you get up to the chief constable level, yeah. You know, is very, very important. And I think those that can see their direction, those that are planning for their lives, understand that they are going to be viewed, and their past is going to be reviewed as well. Because, you know, I am just so grateful that some of the antics that I got up to were before the use of iPhones and such like. Yeah. There's no evidence. But I think you have the other side that, you know, move from one place to another happen to find themselves going up through the ladder and then going, oh my goodness, you know, well, hang on a minute, is that going to come back to haunt me? Mm. Which probably then ties back into where you started with the, oh my goodness, I'm going to get found out as a fraud.
Yeah.
How can I be this? Because, for instance, and I'm suddenly 19 to the dozen here, so my apologies, but I'm actually thinking of a particular instance where I went over to Munich, and I was putting on this training course over 3 days, and Compaq in Munich used to hold, on a Saturday, they had squash. So that everybody would turn up to play squash for the afternoon and there would be a little mini league. And I turned up. I was a good squash player at the time. Went through the whole day, had a really great time. And then we came to the end of the day when we had to shower. And I had to turn around. I mean, not that I'm a little bit body conscious as most Brits are, and the Germans are a little less so. But when it was going into the showers, I suddenly realised they were mixed showers. And I thought, I cannot be standing up in front of them tomorrow morning, training them on something, and they know how I look naked.
Yeah.
I couldn't do it. I could not do it. I'm going to go and have a private shower. And they all thought I was rather odd. And I felt as though I wasn't one of the crowd. But I knew that there were certain things that, to be able to put myself in a position where I would feel comfortable and I could hold my head up, I needed to make those types of decisions. But it's two camps. It really is.
It's an interesting one, that, isn't it, when it comes to culture, because it wouldn't even have occurred to them to think any differently of you, because their culture, to them, that's perfectly normal. So it's really interesting when you start to get different cultures and what's acceptable and what isn't acceptable. You know, I heard a similar story from my business partner when he was in Scandinavia. And he thought, whoa, okay. All in the sauna, hang on a minute, I'm training you lot tomorrow, how's this going to work? But it's really weird, isn't it, you know, what feels comfortable for us, and crossing those cultural boundaries is an absolute minefield, potentially a minefield. Yeah, I mean, that's a whole training course we could put on just on understanding cultural differences. And yeah, I mean, certainly when I work with people, what I find is that, interestingly, people have a fear of success more than a fear of failure. What's your experience?
Yes, I think we're used to doing something and it not happening. So when we're starting to do something new, we expect to fail. So the fear isn't so much there. You know, the little year-old baby that's getting up on its feet is you know, going round and falls over but gets up, and you know, and mum and dad's there going, come on, you can do this. It's the other side of it when whatever you do, you're ultimately going to get measured by it. So the bigger your success, the bigger the measurement is going to be. And you know that, and it, unfortunately, it's so prevalent in this country too, in that we are boosted up, we're put on a pedestal, and we go, yes, we've made it, and somebody tips the pedestal over. And that, I think, is, you know, if I've managed to achieve this, where to now, and how are people going to look at me? And having the guts to measure yourself by your own standards, define your own levels of success, as opposed to looking externally for other people to pat you on the back or alternatively knock you off your own pedestal. Again, it's bringing that mindset into play. How do we make ourselves think well of ourselves when people around us might not necessarily be thinking the same?
It's a tricky one, that, isn't it? And that's, I mean, I love being British, but that part of the British culture is a bit that I find very challenging. You know, that we love building people up and then bringing them back down. You know, we love the underdog. So if you get a little bit too big for your boots, we're just going to knock you off and just bring you back to where we can kick you. And what I love about Americans, having spent quite a lot of time there, is that they really celebrate success in a way we don't do on nearly the same level in the UK. It's really interesting, that mindset.
I think we're starting to get it. I still don't think that some of their expansive language sits well with us. Oh my goodness, you are awesome. And I'm thinking, no, I've just done my job. That's all I'm doing. I'm awesome when I do my job and these 1.5 million other things happen as a result of it. But at the moment today, I'm quite calm in my Britishness. And it's also, I think we also see them. We're starting to get where they come from, because my idea of Americans some years ago was how big and how brash they are, and oh my goodness, I don't need to know about absolutely everything. But I now am starting to understand, and now I'm starting to appreciate how being able to stand up, and I still can't do the I'm awesome bit, but to be able to stand up and say, yeah, I can do that. Yes, I am good at that. Yes, I can make that thing, whatever that thing is, happen. And that's been something I've had to teach myself by looking at people that do it so much bigger and so much better than I.
Yeah.
And to be able to be confident enough in yourself to understand, okay, so people might not get me all the time. People might want to be knocking me down, but I'm okay in who I am and what I achieve. And that comes with that, just doing it over and over again, just being able to be a little bit more self-aware, being able to talk to people and be able to say, I am okay, I can do this, and I'm comfortable in how I do it. And that's something that, again, it's a British thing. Oh, no, you know, self-deprecation, you know, that's fine, no, I'm not going to take any credit for my achievements. There's a balance to be had, obviously.
There is a balance to be had, isn't there? I mean, something I say to clients a lot is, what other people think of you is none of your business.
I like that.
And because we make it our business. And a lot of people can base their decisions on the views of other people. And it's recognising that other people's opinion of you is coming from their view of the world in that current second, in that current moment. And we have no idea what their backstory is most of the time, and what might be going on for them, and what buttons we may have pressed completely inadvertently. And it's also not our responsibility. So that ability to stand in your own space and be the best version of yourself for yourself is really the key, but also incredibly difficult, because we are historically brought up to be people pleasers, most of us, aren't we?
Yes, yeah. I think that goes right the way back, before we were even humans as human beings, and how we operate now. It's that gregariousness that we have, that coming together as a flock or a crowd, that you don't want to be the person on the outside, or you didn't want to be the animal on the outside, because the animal that's on the outside is the one that actually gets pushed off to one side. You know, if you're lacking, you're left at the back, because that's where the hyenas will come first. And we still have those very, very innate, it's not abilities, but it's a feature of our own personality, our own animalistic human personality, that we don't want to be out on the outside. So to stand outside the crowd or above the crowd and be this most brilliant, brilliant person, you are putting your head above that parapet and you are not going to go along with everybody else. You're going to have different thoughts, different ideas, because you're in a different place. And that makes it difficult, particularly for people that seem to fast track through life. That you suddenly find, you know, these young kids, they're off and they're doing this and they're doing that, and the world is suddenly expanding at a rate of knots, and they're leaving their what were peers behind, and then having to find the way in the next place. And it's almost that you have to upgrade your peer group each time you do it. It's not saying you're leaving people behind, but just how you're interacting and such like might not match the peer group that you were in. But you as an individual still have to have people like-minded around you. And that transition, again, back to that leadership thing, that transition of moving from one place to another, still maintaining your core integrity. You know, be careful on who you tread up on the way up, because you'll meet them on the way back down. But at the same time, to go up that ladder, you have to step on those rungs. And that is, it's such a fine line. And I think we will often not make some choices and not make some decisions because we are too fearful of getting too big and too bright.
Yeah, and it's that bright, isn't it? We're hesitant to shine too strongly, you know, to be that North Star. We kind of want to merge into the rest of the galaxy, and you know, there's a lot of safety with anonymity.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Yeah.
So tell us a bit more about your journey to where you are today. So you went straight from school to work within the IT industry. What was that transition?
It really wasn't a transition, it was an extension, because I had heard at age 9 about this thing called a computer. I said to my dad, "What's that?" And he said, "I don't know, some sort of magic chain." So I came home with a Ladybird book of computers, and I had at the time an eidetic memory, so I remembered absolutely everything that I read, saw, and that's, even today, is how my brain takes information. I'm nowhere near as good as I was being able to retain it. Ages hit me, but I still remember the book, and I still remember the back of the book with a picture of an old-fashioned data center and a list of jobs, and one of the jobs was a systems analyst, and this 9-year-old geek went, "I'm going to be one of those." Wow. So going into school and out the other end, that was all I was focused on. I was going to be a systems analyst. So I left school at 16. I was a single mum at 17. I went into one company that happened to have, I did some typing, and they happened to have a computer that they were linking up, and I went, "Yeah, I can read the book." So I went and read the book and linked it up in a network. From there, got into Compaq as a network assistant. Within the year, I was the network manager and heading up the Compaq network group. And I went from IT role to IT role to IT role. So network manager, test manager, quality assurance manager, project manager, program manager, anything that had manager in the title, that was me. And, you know, just applied the same skills all the way. I've got an ability in that I have a fairly male-dominated brain, but I've got the empathy and the women as well. So I can end up sitting in between, talking the language, which is a lot more, a lot broader, the more hows and whys and interconnections and such like, which is the female brain, but then actually be able to bring it down to short, sharp sentences, which is the male brain. So I was able to float between the two. And yet I was still a woman and still having to choose where to sit on a bank of tables. Otherwise, I would be the secretary. Mm-hmm. I touch type, and I'm able to touch type and be able to do that, facilitate a meeting, partake in the meeting, and take all the notes at the same time. And therefore, somebody would say, "Oh, Elaine, could you take an action point, please?" And in fact, it was those words that made me decide, right, that's it, I've had enough of this corporate lark. But this was after sort of 30-odd years.
Wow.
So I ended up thinking, well, if I've had these struggles, how can I help other people? I started off doing training in leadership and collaboration, but the last 5 or 6 months been moving across to working with women, for women, and on behalf of women, which doesn't mean to say I don't work with men, because I think we as women have to understand what it's like to be in a man's world, the world of business, which is traditionally set up for men, and how we maintain our femininity, maintain our softness, but actually give to the party. But also, from the male perspective, there are things about how we operate that doesn't necessarily tie in well with their mode either. And it's only by bringing the two together, by bringing the languages together, by bringing the sense of inclusion together, that we will end up with something that means that gender is just not important. It'll be the right person for the right job, and we will adjust our styles according to that person. And it's down to really, really quite simplistic things. Women, we use a lot of words. I was actually at a keynote the other day, and the men laughed when I said, I'm sorry, I've got to use my 3,500 words. But women, we've got to give the men a break by being able to come down to detail, to not come down to detail, but to be able to give the high-level approach when we're describing something. We don't need to delve into absolutely everything. And it's little things like that. I had a boss that just couldn't get me, because he'd asked me to do something, and I would then be, you know, what, why, how, what about so-and-so, what about so-and-so, what about so-and-so? And he goes, no, you know, I'm just asking you to do this. And I'm thinking, but if I do that, then that's going to impact, and that's going to impact, and that's going to impact. And that's something that is, it's not, I'm not saying it's female, but it's a more of a female brain characteristic of being able to look at the whole broader aspect, whereas the men tend to be very, very clear on direction, and they have a great clarity of being able to pinpoint specifics.
Okay, and that probably I'm going to interject there.
Yeah, please.
Because part of me is agreeing with you. Part of me is disagreeing with you.
Okay.
And there's also another comment in what you've just said that I will come back to when we have time, because you just said it and then you carried on. I think, whoa, hang on a minute, but we'll come back to that in a minute. So what's coming through for me here is a little bit of conflict. So what I'm hearing from you in one side is it's about gender ideally not being important and about inclusivity, and then you talk about the male and the female brain. So by default, that's divisive. So what I want to say to you is I agree that different people think in a different way, but I'm challenging you on how helpful it is to put the labels of male and female on that. Because I have come across women who talk in bullet points, and I've come across men who talk in novels. So it's about, because I do a lot of work on personality profiling, and I talk about the four quarters of the brain, top, bottom, left and right. I have had just as many women in the top left as I have men in the bottom right. Now, if you're talking about gender, top left is uber masculine and bottom right is uber feminine.
Yes.
But I don't find it helpful to put those labels on it, because if you say to a man who's bottom right, you have a very feminine brain, or to a woman who's top left, you've got a very masculine brain, that's not going to go down well. And it isn't helpful.
Don't, okay, I take that point on board. I think the words that I'm using, the fact that you're coming back to me to say that they are divisive, I hear that. What I'm trying to differentiate between is not that it's men that do this and women that do that, but we have characteristics that tend to be more prevalent in one sex or another. So if we go to choices on jobs, the chances are that a nursing role has a tendency to have a female as part of that role rather than men. Now, that may well be down to tradition and what have you, but there are aspects of the nursing industry that lend itself more to those feminine characteristics.
Or is it society projecting what is socially acceptable to the different genders?
I think in that particular instance, no. I think, and going back to IT, predominantly in the more technical type roles, there are more men. I am very, very much one for inclusion, but I don't think diversity with a capital D, making sure it's 50% men and 50% women, is actually going to resolve the issue. Because IT, technical IT, very often is just not something that women are particularly interested in. Now, some of that is down to how we're brought up, but a lot of it, I believe, is because actually going down to those ones and zeros, those bits and bytes and such like, is a more masculine type activity than a feminine activity.
Or it's more of a left brain dominant, which doesn't automatically mean masculine. Yeah. And is it the fact that when you touched on when we're brought up, that actually the perceptions of the education system don't encourage women to explore left brain dominant careers?
We've flipped and flopped backwards and forwards in our methods of teaching. We have had a situation many years ago. I was working for National Strategies, and they were actively encouraging teaching to change from one style to another because the teaching was actually favouring the girls' way of working and not the boys. They then swapped it over and found that the girls are actually going backwards again because of, and it's being generalistic, but the method of teaching was actually more applicable to the way that one person's brain worked against the other. And so we have to recognise that there are gender differences. We have to recognise that across all females and across all males are different ways of working, whether that's a feminine or a masculine or whatever. The idea of inclusion is to actually be able to embrace all of those, regardless of, you know, whether you're male, female, whether, you know, whether it's race, colour, creed, that we actually just accept that person for the individual that they are. Our training, our teaching at school, and I inadvertently use the word training, and I think that basically sums up how I think about it, is that we have a core set of things that we indoctrinate our children with for them to come out and actually pass their exams. And that indoctrination and that training doesn't take into consideration that one of those children will work in one way and another one of those children will work in the other. And unfortunately, what happens with IT specifically, because I know that, is that we end up with a situation that we have robots and coding and games and things like that, which are all what little boys like, but there's not a huge amount for the little girls to like in that industry. So whilst we start them off at a relatively level playing field, by the time some of the STEM programs, the science, technology, maths and what have you, by the time they take place in their teens, we've already lost those girls that might have had something really wonderful to add to the IT world, but they're lost because they're not interested. So some of it is about what we teach, but a lot of it is about how we teach it, and we have to recognise that people take things in different ways.
They do, but it's interesting. I just picked up a friend last week who's been in hospital, and there were more male nurses than there were female.
That's very interesting.
So I think the tide is turning, that it's more, and it is about social expectations. And if we go back to where we started this conversation, it's about fitting in. And maybe women were discouraged from a very STEM focused career because they didn't feel they fitted in, and how would they be viewed by other women? And maybe men were put off going into more of the caring professions because they were worried about how they would be viewed. So it's again going back to that statement, what other people think of you is none of your business. So if we go full circle, it is about being the best version of you regardless of what other people think of you.
Yes.
And finding out what your passion is and how your brain is wired regardless of your gender.
Yes.
You know, because I know when I did the personality profile on myself, I'm 67% right brain and only 33% can't even add up, left brain. So, you know, I know my natural inclinations are in the collaboration, the teamwork, the people, the empowering, the listening, the inspiring, the risk taking, the fun. That's predominantly. But I've also met a lot of men. My partner's also that as well.
Yeah.
And he can be off the scale with his left brain. So it is really interesting. The point I wanted to pick up on you, this throwaway comment where you just moved really, really quickly on, and that kind of lodged in my brain. Okay, we've got to come back to this one. I left school at 16 and I was a single mother by 17. And then I went into Compaq and then I went, blah, 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 and anything with a manager. I was like, hang on a minute. A, when, what year was this? And B, how the hell did you cope?
I coped through having the vision.
Okay.
My vision had been at age 9 that that's what I was going to do.
You talk about a support network at the age of 16. What year was that? And
the age of 16, I think for me, actually, it was not so much the support network, but it was that I didn't have anybody telling me I couldn't do it.
Okay.
Being a bit flippant, anybody that could actually spell the word IT could probably get into it.
So what year are we talking about?
76. So it was 69, so it was the year of the lunar landing that I decided I wanted to be a systems analyst. I did my schooling, which, again, because of this memory that I had, basically I didn't attend any of the lessons because all I had to do was read the book and therefore spew the book out at the end of it, and then I'd get my qualifications, and effectively that's what I did. I ended up, as I say, at 17 having my daughter. My support network, I mean, my dad wasn't around. My mum was trying to cope with bringing my brother up, who was 6 years younger than me. I had a daughter, and I knew that the only person that was really going to make a difference in my life was me. I was going to be the one that was going to have to do it if I was going to do it. And I still had that dream that I want to be a systems analyst. So it ended up, because that was just so fixed in my brain, that anytime I looked at anything, that was there. It was sitting there, and it was filed in the back called Wistful, but it was still sitting there. So when I ended up in a company that had some IT, I'd naturally gravitate to it because that's where my interest was.
But we were born in the same year, because in 76 I was the same age you were. So
we've just told the whole world how old we are.
Yeah,
now.
That's all right. That's all right. We look 20 years younger, Elaine. Don't worry about it. So I also am aware of the questions I was asked at the age, because I also left school at 17 and left school on Friday, started work the following Monday, been at it ever since.
Yeah.
And I can remember the questions at interview that I was asked, when are you planning to get married and have children? The questions that are now illegal, but weren't in the mid-1970s. So, and I'm also aware of the lack of support for mothers, let alone single mothers, and let alone teenage single mothers. So you were going through this. I mean, now it'd be tricky. Then it was nigh on impossible. So you kind of very, not glibly, but kind of, you just kind of said, well, but practically, how did you do it?
So I recall going down to the shops where my daughter was about 5 or 6 months old. I suffered badly from postnatal depression, wouldn't go out of the house by myself because of, I was thinking about what everybody else thought of me. I went out down to the shops to get my daughter some formula milk, and I had to do that because she had to eat. And I remember my mum's neighbours, and I clearly remember my mum's neighbours talking about me as I walked in with a pram. And I remember coming home and I was absolutely heartbroken by it. And my mum, I told my mum some time later, and she was absolutely horrified and wished that she'd have known. You say that people don't get the support. No, we didn't get the support. I do remember benefits being such an absolute minimum that my daughter had very, very, very wide feet. And she was already up on her, she was up on her feet and walking around the furniture at 6 months old. And she was actually walking unaided by 10 months old. And so she needed a pair of shoes, and I had no money for shoes. I went to the benefits and they said, no, you can't have it. So I couldn't go down to the charity shop and get some shoes. My daughter wouldn't even fit into the charity shop. I had to have them specially shipped in from Clark's because of her wide feet. So there wasn't that support. What I did have at the time, which I don't believe is being done now, was I had you were offered the ability to have stepping stones. Today you get benefits. If I want to work tomorrow, my benefits stop immediately. So to try and break out of that situation is really difficult, almost impossible, which is why I think we've got a lot of people on benefits. At the time, however, there was the most wonderful nursery school that was a couple of miles from me that was council run. And they would charge you according to your means. So when I decided that this idea of benefits, which I could not live on, I could just about get food, I could not live on, and I couldn't give for my daughter, and I couldn't bring my daughter up in the way that I wanted to bring her up, I decided that I had to get out to work. And I had that as a support network. So when I started, because I was on benefits, I was literally paying what was, I think it was about 90 pence a week for my daughter's, to be looked after. And then when I ended up getting into Compaq, I got into Compaq after my daughter left nursery. But as I progressed through to, the better the job, the better the job, and I was bringing money, more money in, the amount that I was paying to them went up and up and up. So it meant that I could go out to work today, and I could make sure that I had some income today to be able to pay for the month, so that at the end of it, I could feed and clothe my daughter, and I had a roof over my head. The roof over my head was for my mum. To be able to move out from my mum's was a 5-year waiting list, which I waited for, and I eventually got out, so because I did not want to be a mum at home with my mum. And then I also had, and it was so much easier then, the ability to get onto the housing ladder. The cost of the houses in the locale were such that a single parent like me could do it, but it was still hard work. But ultimately, the only person going to help was me. And I don't think we have that energy in our youngsters now. They have so much that are given to them, and they're not prepared for life in as good a way as we probably were with, at our age 16. Because we knew, I came from a background, I used to love egg and chips. Mm-hmm. Egg and chips was a rarity for me. What I didn't realise at the time is it was a Thursday meal. Dad didn't get paid until Friday, and that was the only thing that we had in the cupboard. I remember doing some spaghetti bolognese for myself and my daughter, and she was 6, and I had a t-shirt with a long wide sleeve, and I caught the wide sleeve and I dropped one of the meals. My daughter ate that night, I didn't. So I'm not saying it for a soft story, but I knew I could only rely on myself, and I didn't have anybody around me that's saying, oh no, you can't go that far, you can't do this. I think primarily because they didn't actually know what it was I wanted to do. I mean, even the teachers in the school, you want to do what? They hadn't got an idea of what this looked like, whereas I did, and I always had that look and the drive.
So what was the culture like within those strongly, if you want to use that word, masculine industry in the 70s of employing a single mother?
I'm trying to think whether I ever got asked the question. And I don't think I ever did. I don't think I ever got asked the question. I think probably because I came in as a strong person. I think because I was so young, I don't think I mentioned it, and I don't think they asked, because I was single and young. So because I wasn't married and I wasn't of an age. Therefore, it probably wasn't part of my life.
Interesting. Life is very, very different, isn't it? And we forget sometimes what it was like when you and I were growing up.
Yeah.
Because, my recollection is that every interview being asked those questions, and also being appalled and being really angry, even as a 17-year-old, how would you ask a man this question if you were interviewing him? Even then, when I didn't even know about diversity or equal opportunities or any of that. But I can remember being incensed by being asked the question and the unfairness of being asked that question. Like, whether I'm married or single, what difference does that make to my ability to do my job? And you wouldn't ask a man, so why are you asking me? So that kind of slight pushing back and rebelliousness was there, even though I couldn't categorize it, or I didn't know what to do with that kind of energy. Yes. It's fascinating how our lives have changed. And you're right, I believe and I agree with you that I think children probably, in a way, have it a lot tougher, because I think it's a lot more competitive. It's a lot easier to leave school and get a job the next day in the 70s than it is now. A lot easier. It's far more competitive now, and it's a lot easier now in other ways. And it's really interesting. And I'm sure when teenagers today are the age you and I are now, they'd be saying exactly the same about the teenagers then.
I sound like my grandmother every day. I've bypassed my mum's comments. I'm at my grandmother's comments already. So yeah, I do agree with you. It is more difficult, I think, for the youngsters. And I think one of the difficulties is that there is so much choice.
Mm.
You know, when I was young, there wasn't a choice. There was, I wanted to go on to college. The college ended up canning the course because there wasn't enough people to go on it. So the only choice that I had was to get out to work. The only choice that I had where my daughter was to do it myself. The only choice about having a roof over my head was my mum's. Ultimately, I did for a very short time have a council house, or a council flat. But if I wanted something decent, I had to do it myself. And there wasn't anybody out there at that time in my peer group that believed I couldn't do it. Whereas now, to try and get into the house that I first bought, it was a £3,000 deposit, which absolutely crucified me to find. And I was lucky that I had somebody that helped me. But the amount I was paying in mortgage was less than the amount that I'd been paying in rent. So it actually was beneficial for me to have that £3,000 debt and then have a mortgage. Today, that same house, the house that I had was £33,000. That same house now is around £290,000. Wow. And it's tiny. My grandmother's house, my mum's house, which we bought in 94, 95, at £86,000, is now worth £550,000. And it's a two up, two down terraced cottage. How the kids can get into a situation where they can actually take that's a first-time house, that's a step on the ladder, and the opportunities were there for me to do it. If I was a single mum now, today, the opportunities wouldn't be there. Mm. I would not be able to do it.
Yeah, so life has changed, hasn't it? Life has changed. So what would be the key messages, and what are the key messages that you give to your clients today based on your experiences of life? What has it taught you?
It's taught me that the one person you know you can count on is yourself, and to trust yourself and to believe in yourself. It's taught me that if you truly, truly want something, you can work for it, and most of the time you will get it, because I didn't always get it, mm-hmm. but most of the time. But I think ultimately what kept me going then and what keeps me going now is my vision. What is it that I want for my future? At times when I thought, my goodness, this is all too much, I want to give on, I had that dream of the person I wanted to become. I now have a completely different dream. But I know I will become that person, because that dream, that vision, that direction that I want to go in is so strong. And if anybody's out there, follow your passion. Don't follow somebody else's dreams. Make it your own and really eat, sleep and breathe it. And you'll eventually get there.
Thank you, Lane. That's a great way to end. We will eventually get there. And it reminds me of a quote from Oscar Wilde: always be yourself, because everybody else is taken.
Yes. Can I add another one? If you're not living on the edge, you're taking up too much room.
Brilliant. I love it. Thank you so much. It's been a joy.
It has, Katie. Thanks so much indeed.
You've been listening to Katie Day and Creating Ripples. Listen in and be part of the revolution that is rocking the world. Women are the new future. We are awesome, fearless, fabulous, inspiring, passionate, courageous. In fact, we just rock.